The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And today, President Obama will meet with Vladimir Putin for the first time in nearly a year. Those two leaders haven't formally met since June of 2013, months before President Putin annexed Crimea and armed secessionist rebels in eastern Ukraine. Now the presidents have plenty to discuss aside from Ukraine. President Obama plans to press Vladimir Putin on Russia's support of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and assess Russia's potential as an ally against the self-proclaimed Islamic State in Syria, well, and maybe in Iraq, but maybe not. There is deep division over the future of Assad's Syria. Listen.
We support the legitimate government of Syria. And it's my deep belief that any actions to the contrary in order to destroy the legitimate government will create a situation which you can witness now in the other countries of the region or in other regions, for instance, in Libya, where all the state institutions are disintegrated. We see a similar situation in Iraq.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on 60 Minutes last night. Well, President Obama's taken a lot of heat on Vladimir Putin over the last few years, mostly from Republicans who want to see him take a who want to see him take a tougher stand against the Russian leader. But my next guest says that Putin's increasingly aggressive stance in Syria may in fact be part of the bargain already on the Iran nuclear deal. Joining me is Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College and a friend of the show. Professor Martin, welcome back.
Todd, it's great to be here.
Now, I just said a provocative thing that you're bringing to the table here, which is it's one thing for President Obama to get tough on Putin, who is propping up Assad and may even send in troops to do it. You say this might actually be part of the deal.
Well, a couple of things to think about. First is that Putin can never be seen as giving in to the West. We have been trying to bargain with Putin over the future of Syria since the Geneva process began in June 2012. He has to talk tough. He may be sending some small number of troops, which is what he has right now in Syria, is part of looking tough to his domestic audience. But the key thing is going to be what happens behind closed doors. And it's possible that Putin is sort of waking up and saying, look, things aren't going well in Ukraine. Things aren't going well for the Assad regime. Maybe it's time for me to start having some compromises with the West, but I can't do it publicly, and publicly I have to look tough. You're right, too, that this could also be part of the Iran nuclear bargain. We don't know that for sure, but the timing of it is kind of suspicious because it was the day after that it became clear that the United States was going to go along with the Iran nuclear accord that all of a sudden we started seeing the appearance of Russian military forces in Syria. And we know that the only way that Iran went along with the accord was to get support from Russia to do it. Russia was a key player in the negotiation that led to that nuclear accord. I wouldn't be surprised if part of the bargain was that Iran said, okay, we'll go along with this accord, but you, Russia, have to give more military support to our ally Syria if you want us to do this.
And we should highlight that Iran and Russia have common cause in Syria. That common cause is Assad.
Yes, both Assad and also fear of the Islamic State and fear of what fundamentalists who are extremists coming from the Sunni side could do to destabilize either of their governments.
Now, Vladimir Putin has an additional motivation to wanting to send Russian troops into Syria. Listen to him on 60 Minutes last night about his own problem that he thinks he has in Assad, Syria.
More than 2,000 fighters from Russia and ex-Soviet republics are in the territory of Syria. There's a threat of their return to us. So instead of waiting for their return, we are better off helping Assad fight them on Syrian territory.
There's Vladimir Putin saying, we've got to fight them over there before they fight us over here. That sounds familiar to an American ear in terms of what terrorists might do if they come home to roost.
Right. And I would not be surprised if part of the intelligence sharing that's going on between Russia and Iran and Iraq and Syria is to identify Russian citizens who are from the North Caucasus, who are currently on the ground fighting against the Assad regime. And if part of the reason for Putin's military deployment to Syria is to try to target those Russian citizens so they can't come home again. We do know that over the past year, the Russian intelligence service, the FSB, has been sort of closing its eyes and allowing safe passage for people from the North Caucasus who have been going to fight in Syria. And this may be a way of preventing them from returning home.
They were closing their eyes because they thought they were getting rid of them.
Yes, exactly. Much better to have them in Syria than to have them at home in the North Caucasus in Russia.
So what does it mean then for President Obama in his meeting with Putin today? We assume that the president knows all of the things that you know. He might be sensitive to Putin's need to fight Russian or North Caucasus fighters who are getting combat hardened and trained in Syria. But a Russian buildup in Syria is a problem for us. How does Obama balance this?
Well, a couple things to keep in mind. The first is that so far, the Russian deployments in Syria are relatively small. And so they would not have, at this point, a decisive impact on the war. We don't know what might be coming next, but that's an indication that the Russian presence there might be symbolic and for political reasons more than for any really serious military reasons. But another thing to keep in mind that's dangerous is that Putin is not just after the Islamic State. He is potentially after anybody who would threaten the Assad regime and anybody who might go home to threaten his regime afterwards who would be from the North Caucasus. And many of both of those people are not fighting on behalf of the Islamic State. There's so many different groups who are on the ground in Syria, and it would be possible that Putin and his military forces might go after some of the forces that are actually U.S. allies fighting against the Assad regime. And that's why the deconflicting is so important, because we also know that there are probably some U.S. special forces who are going back and forth into Syria as well to help the people who are fighting against Assad.
So they have a lot of very tangled details to work out between them, who basically rules of engagement are what you're talking about.
That's
extremely complicated. I mean, there are rules of engagement for all of the different factions in Syria, but also it seems increasingly like the case, Kimberly Martin, that Assad remaining in power, which is against U.S. policy, the president himself has said Assad must go, is going to be the price for weakening ISIS. It's starting to seem that way.
And I think, I mean, what we have to pay attention to over the long run is what happens behind closed doors. I would predict that Putin is going to make some sort of a hardline statement. But what happens behind closed doors in those negotiations will be the important part. And it may be that Putin is willing to see that they need some kind of a transition away from Assad to have anything that comes out with a stable situation in Syria.
So there might be leverage then with Vladimir Putin. You're saying that he's not completely in control of this negotiation. He needs things too. He may, in fact, be willing to deal away Bashar Assad eventually if it gets him dead Russian fighters who he doesn't want to come back to Russia and ISIS defeated.
And the thing to keep in mind is that in general, Putin's on a losing streak, right? Things have not been going as well for him in Ukraine as he had been expecting. His economy is tanking. Oil prices don't look like they're going up anytime soon, as an earlier story talked about. And so he really is not having any successes at the moment. He needs a success. And if he can come out and say, my presence of military forces in Syria and my hard line against the West is what led to this peaceful outcome, and they had to take me seriously, and that shows that Russia is a global power again that the West has to cooperate with, that's a win-win situation for everybody.
Well, he got a little bit of that a couple of summers ago, didn't he, when the Russians brokered the deal on Syria's chemical weapons program,
which also served U.S. interests very well. And so, you know, Obama was criticized for being weak, but it was really great to get those chemical weapons out of Syria. And so if Putin can do the same thing again, I think we should be very happy.
Well, Obama's been criticized for being weak as well in Ukraine, because basically President Obama's the only guy in Washington who doesn't want to arm the Ukrainians against Russian-backed separatist forces in the East. Congress wants it. Almost everybody wants it. The White House won't do it. Part of the dividend of this, I suppose, part of it was supposed to be cooperation from Putin on all these other pieces in Iran, in Syria. Is that the case, and are we getting any of that from that decision?
I don't think that Obama's thinking was really that if he didn't arm Ukraine that he would get cooperation from Russia. I think it was his assessment that arming Ukraine is a really bad idea because the Ukrainian military is not a very strong command and control professionalized system. You couldn't control what happened to the weapons once they got on the ground. There are dozens of militias in Ukraine fighting on behalf of Kyiv, but not really under Kiev's control. They've joined this thing that is called the National Guard, but they still have their same command structures, and they have their own political purposes outside of helping Kiev. And so once you send those weapons to Ukraine, you really have no control over where they go. And you know, part of the group of people fighting in Ukraine on behalf of Kiev are Chechens, and so it would be very dangerous to send weapons to Ukraine.
But you've suggested at the same time that all of the sanctions that have grown out of the confrontation in Ukraine, banking sanctions, economic sanctions, are having an effect on Russia may actually be driving Putin to the table back in Syria with us.
Well, I think it's the oil prices that are driving mm-hmm. Putin to the table, which are not related to the sanctions. They just happen to occur simultaneously. But another thing to think about in terms of the possibility of arming Ukraine is that Putin's rhetoric has shifted. Early on in Ukraine, he was talking about it being an ethnic conflict, about him needing to support Russian speakers and so forth. He shifted over the past year to talking about this not being about Ukraine at all, but about the United States threatening Russian borders on the Ukrainian border. And so if the United States were to publicly come out and say, we are arming the Ukrainian government, it feeds into Putin's rhetoric that this is actually the United States threatening Russian borders. And at that point, you could get escalation in Ukraine. But I think what's happening right now is that, you know, things have sort of calmed down in Ukraine. We have this ceasefire so that global attention is on these wonderful things that Putin is going to propose on Syria, to have the possibility of negotiated outcome and the possibility of a good outcome in Syria. I don't predict that the ceasefire in Ukraine is going to last very long. Mm-hmm. Neither side really controls what's happening with the militias on the ground, and it's going to rise up again in the future.
And just to go right back to ISIS before we let you go, Kimberly Martin, we've been talking about Syria, Islamic State in Syria, and Assad. We need to establish here that most of this doesn't have much to do with ISIS in Iraq, and that's potentially even a larger problem.
Well, the border between Syria and Iraq is very porous and very artificial, and in many ways, a lot of the problem that's happening in Syria came about because of the situation that happened in Iraq. And so they're all very much related to each other, and we have a mess.
A mess indeed. Maybe untangling some of the mess, maybe not. President Obama meets with Vladimir Putin on the sidelines at the United Nations today. They have an awful lot to talk about, and Vladimir Putin is increasing his muscle in Syria. Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Todd.
There now appears to be yet another twist in the Hillary Clinton email story. New evidence suggests that Hillary Clinton was using a private email address at the State Department earlier than she had previously stated. New emails have emerged from the address hdr22@clintonemail.com. They're from January and February of 2009, even though Clinton said she started the account in March and that any messages from earlier could not be recovered. Turns out, of course, that's not true. Yesterday on Meet the Press on NBC, Hillary Clinton had a hard time explaining this discrepancy.
Well, it is like a drip, drip, drip. And that's why I said there's only so much that I can control. But what I have tried to do in explaining this is to provide more transparency and more information than anybody that I'm aware of who's ever served in the government. And I'm happy to do that because I want these questions to be answered.
Hillary Clinton has said she did all of this out of convenience. That explanation is getting more and more difficult for more and more people. Joining us now with more is Amy Chozick, political reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And we have to acknowledge that the email story is getting more and more tangled and a little more complicated. Can you sort of pull the thread and tell us exactly where we stand now on what we know about what we know and what we don't know about Hillary's emails?
Well, exactly. In that interview with Meet the Press, Hillary Clinton called it a drip, drip, drip on these emails. And there certainly does seem to be a new drip every day. The latest is that the earliest emails that the campaign handed over dated March 2009. Those are the emails, the thousands of emails they gave over to the State Department. They said there were no emails earlier than that on her private server that they kept at their home in Chappaqua. Now, the State Department has uncovered a string of emails with Petraeus dating back back to January, a couple months earlier than they said that she began using that personal email. Now, you know, her response on Meet the Press was, well, I don't know about that discrepancy, but the campaign has acknowledged that she began using the private email earlier than March, but those emails, they could not find them on the server. So she sort of chalked it up to technical difficulties of why this gap exists in the emails that they handed over and the time that she said she started using the address. So it's just sort of one more development that's making everyone question whether they have been entirely forthcoming and when she started using this personal email.
So it might be fair to assume that Hillary Clinton doesn't program servers and doesn't know when something switches to something else. But you're right, this all kind of goes to another wrinkle in a story that seems to keep having more to it as you scratch at it.
Exactly. And I don't even think the latest development is anything earth shattering, but all of these developments just keep it in the news, keep it in the headlines. You know, it dominated her conversation on the Sunday shows. And I think that that is distracting from her getting her message and policies out and ultimately filtering into some of the polls that we've seen in terms of trustworthiness and voters, you know, having a less favorable opinion of her. Bernie Sanders is at the same time rising and surpassing her in some polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, and that is not the direct result of the email situation by any means, but it does, you know, speak to this larger problem that each one of these developments distracts from her campaign.
Amy Chozick, there's another part of this that I need to understand a little better, which is the FBI investigation. Now, if you read the partisan emails and commercials on the GOP side, Hillary Clinton is under criminal investigation. Is that really true? And what is the nature of what the FBI is looking at in relation to her emails?
No, she is not under criminal investigation. There is a FBI security investigation into how these different agencies classify information and sort of whether classified information was mishandled at the State Department. And that is a security inquiry, I believe they call it. So not directly related to Hillary Clinton, but it is looking into, you know, some of these emails are classified after the fact. Different agencies require different emails to be classified. And so the FBI is looking into whether classified information was mishandled at the State Department.
So if the FBI finds that she handled classified information improperly, is she in trouble, or would she have had to have known intentionally that it was classified?
That is unclear. I think that there's a lot of different agencies that classify different emails, and so there's some conflicting accounts there. But it certainly would only add to the furor over the emails if they were to unearth mishandled classified information.
So, Amy Chozick, where does this all go? I mean, you've talked about the drip, drip, drip. Hillary herself has talked about that. There is more to come on this. All of this has come out because of the Benghazi committee in Congress, and Hillary herself has agreed to testify in the third week in October. So what's to be expected here, both for her and for her campaign? The story absolutely doesn't go away at this point.
Absolutely. I mean, they are really trying to put a positive spin on her testimony to the Benghazi committee. They are saying we are being as transparent as possible. They are really hoping that after getting grilled by the committee and answering all of these questions, that the public will move on, that the media will move on. I'm not sure that's the case, because a lot of this, as Hillary Clinton has said, is out of her control. The State Department is releasing thousands of emails on this rolling schedule. And so every time they release new emails, that dominates the conversation. As you said, she is testifying at the Benghazi committee, and that's a critical time. That's 2 weeks after the first Democratic debate. You know, it's really leading into the home stretch in front of the Iowa caucus, the New Hampshire primary. It's a critical time. They're hoping that can be a turning point, but I'm not so sure.
Amy Chozick, before we let you go, I saw a lot of tweets from a lot of Clinton allies over the weekend that had that exact same phrase. They all said, time to move on. It seems like everybody had read the same memo. I don't know if it's going to work.
Right. That was clearly a coordinated effort. And look, I understand some of their frustration. Hillary Clinton has unveiled some pretty in-depth policies. you know, very down to excruciating detail of how she would pay for things like making college more affordable and making prescription drugs more affordable. And I think there's a real frustration in her campaign and her and among her allies that people aren't talking about that, that people are, you know, we are talking about the emails. And so that frustration clearly came out in some kind of coordinated effort on social media after the Meet the Press interview. And I think we'll continue to see that. But whether it changes the conversation, I'm not sure.
A serious campaign full of serious policy at this point being almost completely overshadowed by an email imbroglio of Hillary Clinton's own making, or largely of her own making. Amy Chozick, political reporter at our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks.
As President Obama and Vladimir Putin go nose to nose at the UN, in Congress, House Speaker John Boehner is turning his back. Last Friday, Speaker Boehner walked up to a lectern in the Capitol, sounding like a man without a care in the world.
My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
And Boehner said in that press conference that he's been contemplating quitting for more than a year, but that he'd woken up on Friday morning after a night reflecting on his private visit with Pope Francis the day before.
Last night I started thinking about this, and this morning I woke up and I said my prayers, as I always do, and I decided, you know, today's the day I'm going to do this. As simple as that. That's the code I've always lived by. If you do the right things for the right reasons, the right things will happen.
The right things for the right reasons. One of John Boehner's favorite catchphrases. He has lots of other ones, I can tell you. Now, John Boehner has led House Republicans since 2010. He was in the leadership long before that, and he represented Ohio's 8th congressional district outside of Cincinnati for 25 years. Now, those folks in that district have to live without John Boehner, and so does the rest of Ohio. So how does the quintessential swing state cope with a political climate when even their conservative favorite son isn't conservative enough for today's GOP? With more is Terry Studer. She's campaign committee chair for the Ohio Federation of Republican Women. Terry, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
Almost no one on Capitol Hill saw this coming. Kevin McCarthy, who is Boehner's deputy, found out 2 minutes before this announcement. It must have shocked you.
Some people certainly are surprised at the timing of it. Certainly there are some of us who may be disappointed at the timing of it because we still feel that he could accomplish some of the things that we'd like to see get done. But people here in the district who know John Boehner know that he will always do what he considers to be the right thing for the party. And I think at this time, with all the distractions, he felt it was the right time and the right thing to do for the party.
Now let's talk about the division in the Republican Party that's largely responsible for this resignation. Here's Boehner over the weekend talking about some of the members of his own party.
Absolutely, they're unrealistic. The Bible says beware of false prophets.
Terry Studer, he's calling them false prophets. Before you answer, I want to play another favorite son of Ohio. Listen to John Kasich over the weekend.
And so a lot of the people who are doing the complaining and saying, why isn't anything getting done? Maybe they ought to look in the mirror. What have they accomplished?
Both of those Ohio gentlemen, Boehner and Kasich, are talking about the right wing of their own party. Kasich is saying, guys, look in the mirror. You can kick Boehner out. You're still not going to get anything done.
That's not what's preventing them from getting things done. Certainly there's a faction of the Republican Party that is just fed up. And when you're fed up, you don't want to hear that things can't be done. You want to hear that they can be. And there's a lot of political rhetoric out there from candidates or from elected officials who want to tell voters what they want to hear. And whether or not that reflects realistically what can be done, I think that disconnect there is what has caused a lot of this division within the party.
I think one thing you can say for John Boehner and his leadership, and at least his term as Speaker of the House, that anger and frustration was never really the place that he worked from. I mean, I'm sure he experienced it, but he never really came to the table with that. I mean, he was a pragmatist.
That certainly was always his attitude. I know I've had personal conversations with him where I've said, how can you put up with this? How do you every day go back into the fire? And he said, I get up every day. I tell myself I'm going to do the best I can. I go off, I do it. And at night, I say my prayers. I tell myself I did the best I can, and I go to bed. And I think he's that resiliency, that determination to just every day do what he could, the best he could, is something that we look for in every politician. That's the most we could hope from anyone.
Terry Studer, campaign committee chair for the Ohio Federation of Republican Women, on John Boehner. Terry Studer, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My oh my, what a wonderful day.
Welcome back to the show. Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry, and some news from Audi, which belongs to Volkswagen. Audi says the deceptive software used to cheat on emissions tests at Volkswagen was used in 2.1 million of its cars. The company has suspended its brand managers for Volkswagen, Porsche, and Audi, and today German prosecutors announced that they are opening an investigation into former CEO Martin Winterkorn on his involvement in the deceptive diesel engines. It's a lot for Volkswagen's new CEO Matthias Müller to deal with, as his company faces a diminished brand name and the possibility of billions of dollars in government fines. Our next guest says it's going to take unique leadership to overcome this mess at VW. Bob Lutz is former General Motors vice chairman and former president at Chrysler. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
It's good to have you. Bob Lutz, I wouldn't suggest that you would have okayed something like VW okayed with its pollution cheating software. But you can imagine being in this position, having been at the head of a big car company with a major crisis on its hands. What do you do?
Well, first of all, there are different kinds of crises. Toyota unintended acceleration, Ford Firestone tire problems, General Motors ignition switches. These were all, you could call them industrial mistakes. Somebody made a mistake. Somebody created a bad part, which resulted in loss of life, tragically. These are errors of omission, and you could say, well, there was a lack of proper oversight, but there was no willful misconduct on the part of senior management. What makes this one different and very intractable is the fact that it was a willful, unlawful act on the part of somebody, and we don't know how high that goes. The other part that's different about this Volkswagen crisis is the others were all solvable. The problem with the Volkswagen diesel emission scandal is there's no way to fix it.
Well, there is a difference, surely, in the omission versus the commission, as you say, but also in the GM scandal, $900 million to settle a criminal charge that executives knew about the ignition switches and said nothing. Similar issue at Toyota. So there are some similarities here in that the top of the company seems to have known about the problem, even if it was one of their own making, but never said anything.
Look, we can argue this one all day, but I will tell you, nobody I knew at General Motors at a senior level knew about that problem. If they had known, they would have acted. Morality aside, what makes this case interesting is that there is, as far as anybody knows, no easy technical solution to getting it fixed. That's what makes it so hard to deal with.
And so now questions, of course, swirl about who knew what, when, who ordered it, and when. Criminal charges are almost certainly coming for people in the company. It's impossible to know for whom at this point. Help us be inside the boardroom of a company like VW right now. What's it like, and what do you do? What's next?
Well, they've already done a lot of things that are correct. You know, in crisis management, the first rule is once you find out, and this is the opposite of what Hillary Clinton does, by the way, but once there's a problem, you put it all out on the table at once. Volkswagen did that because the early reporting was 500,000 cars in the U.S., and then Volkswagen said, oh, we looked into this, and it's a total of 11 million cars worldwide. So they did that correctly. The other thing they did correctly, although probably unfairly for the individual, the board asked the chairman, Martin Winterkorn, to resign. And he willingly resigned and said, I do this despite the fact that I had no knowledge of this and that I am personally shocked anyone in this company would have such a lapse of basic morality and ethics. That is always a good thing to do because it demonstrates that the board is taking this absolutely seriously and that the top people have to pay the penalty. So I think that's what the company is doing, and that's all good. And yes, there will be criminal fines, probably in the States and in Germany, but that's not the bad part. The bad part is they can't sell diesel cars right now. And unlike Firestone tires or ignition switches, there's no part that you can swap out to make these cars work right.
Is there ever a point as a senior executive, you can speak for yourself, where you might say, at this point, it's just not worth saving. You can't sell cars right now. Nobody's ever going to trust us. Maybe tank the brand and move on. Does that enter anybody's mind, or is it worth saving?
Well, first of all, Volkswagen has multiple brands, most of which don't have the problem. The problem is concentrated on Volkswagen. Let's say they get a $10 billion fine in the United States. The maximum fine is, I think, $13 or $14 billion. Because they can't fix the cars, the only thing they can do is select the engine management program that actually passed the test. The problem is that engine management program is legal, but the car doesn't drive well with it, and it accelerates poorly, has poor drivability, and has lousy fuel consumption, which means that all of the owners in the United States, 500,000 of them, launch class action suits. And if you Google Volkswagen lawsuits, you can't even scroll through all of the lawyers that are offering their services.
Already?
So, oh, yeah. So these guys, these are circling like vultures over a warm carcass. These people say, this isn't the car we bought. This thing has lousy fuel economy, drives lousy, et cetera, et cetera. It may be clean, but I don't care about that. I liked it the way it was before. Let's say there's a $5 or $6 billion settlement there, and then they have to fix all of the cars in Europe, which is, at some point, you're up to the $30 and $40 billion that this costs.
Right. I mean,
there's no way that any company can absorb that. So,
and that's part of the question. I mean, VW has Audi and Bentley, Bugatti, Lamborghini, Porsche. All those things are fine. But the Volkswagen brand, as you mentioned, all of what you're saying, Mr. Lutz, suggests that they may have to scrap it.
Scrapping the Volkswagen brand isn't going to help the corporate cash situation. You can't just walk away from the liability by scrapping the brand. Problem that would worry me the most if I were CEO of Volkswagen right now. There is no known fix that works, and the whole thing is going to cost more money than any corporation has. The only way out at some point is to go to the German government, plead financial hardship, and Germany isn't about to drop Volkswagen. It's crown industrial jewel of Germany. It drives a big part of the economy. So I don't think the German government would ever let Volkswagen go bankrupt. My guess is there'll be some sort of solution in Europe where they say, well, okay, you have to pay the fine, but you don't have to fix these cars. You know, we'll grandfather them for another 5 years.
The United States has some experience in bailing out a major car maker, and maybe that experience is coming to Germany, too. A crisis of its own making, and right now, no way out except maybe a bailout, says Bob Lutz, former General Motors vice chairman and former president of Chrysler. Bob Lutz, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
On Friday, we'll get the latest job numbers for the month of September, but that breakdown of who's working and who's not in America, I can't imagine that many labor statisticians are thinking too much about the mermaid economy.
My name is...
That's a real thing. According to Fast Company magazine, there are about 1,000 people working as full-time mermaids and mermen in the United States. Linda Walbort is one of them, and she spoke with Takeaway producer Berkeley Wilson.
I am without my tail. I'm about 5'4". I'm pretty tiny, but I have long blonde wavy hair and green blue ocean colored eyes and a big smile. So I have a tail that is a beautiful, very realistic silicone prosthetic tail made by special effects artists in Hollywood. So the tail was designed to look, move, and just completely imitate that look of a real fish or a mermaid.
And how many times do you have to correct kids that mermaids are supposed to have red hair?
You know, a lot of children ask me, do you know Ariel? Is Ariel your sister? And I often tell them that she's a very dear friend of mine, but no, we are not related.
Berkeley wanted to know how Lyndon manages to get around the ocean, especially since pollution's become such a major problem.
I believe since my ancestors were swimming through the seven seas, there has been a lot of stress on our oceans. We've experienced not only a change in the amount of noise underwater, just noise pollution from human interaction with our oceans through cargo ships and sonar pings and all kinds of other noise disturbances that hurt the echolocation and sound utilization that different animals, marine mammals use. But also we have the stresses of different pollution. We have plastic pollutions. We have the Pacific Gyre, which is a huge area that is full of plastic. So mermaids and mermen are swimming through a lot more plastic than they used to. We see a big change in the coral reef health around the world. I work with an organization called Reef Check Worldwide that monitors the health of reefs all around the world. And we're seeing a huge shift for the negative, unfortunately, in the health of our reefs, rocky reefs and coral reefs worldwide.
What's the strangest thing you've seen while swimming?
I've seen so many things. It's hard to say. I think the most unusual thing that I have ever experienced was off the coast of Puerto Rico. There is an island called Vieques, and I was able to swim in a bay of bioluminescence. So to see creatures underwater at night in complete darkness, but I could see their outlines glowing in this bioluminescent glow of the ocean, which is these little tiny organisms called dinoflagellates that glow at nighttime, was probably the strangest yet most beautiful and magical and enchanting thing I've seen.
Now, Linda knows that mermaid life isn't for everyone, but for her, it's been a dream come true.
I believe that everybody should follow their heart and their dream in whatever they want to do. And if that involves wearing a magical, mythical mermaid tail and swimming through the water, whether that's a swimming pool, a puddle, a fountain, or an ocean, to live and experience your fantasy and share that with the world in your own special way, I say go for it. It's an incredible way to live life. It's a magical way to experience the world. And there's nothing more magical than looking around, and no matter who you look at, a smile takes over their face when you make eye contact with them. And that is the wonder of being a mermaid.
And what about benefits? Do you have a 401k? Is there a health benefits? What's the pay like?
It's an interesting thing. Being a mermaid professionally has been a very interesting path for which there was no business model. So I started off doing this 10 years ago, creating a business from which there was nothing to model after. I truly had to create it, build it, dream it, paint it, sew it, wear many, many different hats in order to make this happen. So it has been challenging, to say the least. I have finally come to a place where I feel very content in what I'm doing. I know there's nothing else I could ever do. And it does pay me some nice sand dollars, and I'm very happy about that.
That's professional mermaid Lyndon Walbort speaking with our own Berkeley Wilson.
Under the sea, when the sardine begin to be seen, it's music to me. What do they got?
A lot of sand.
We got a hot crustacean band. Each little clam here know how to jam here
under the sea.
Each little slug here cutting a rug here
under the sea.
Each little snail here know how to whale here. That's why it's hotter under the water. Yeah, we in luck here, down in the muck here
under the sea.
And before we let you go today, here's a story with lots of implications for all of the creatures who live under the sea. And for a lot of the creatures who live on the side of it, for that matter, it was less than a month ago when President Obama was in Alaska, as a matter of fact, that we talked about a massive bet for Shell and a major foray into Arctic drilling. It was a huge drilling investment and major exploration with implications for Alaskan communities, for their economy, and Alaska confronting both economic need and climate change. Well, after all of that and after all of the billions, bust. Shell is pulling out of their latest bet in the Alaskan Arctic. Dan Dicker is author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Dan Dicker, what happened?
Oh, well, Todd, you know, I said on the last time we were on together that, you know, a potential of oil reserves is one thing, and you can send all the physicists you want to try and figure out what's there. But it's really interesting. You really don't know what you're going to get until you get down. It's sort of like, as I said, the analogy I used was exploratory surgery. Well, they sank the Burger J, their first exploratory well, in prime acreage that they had in the Arctic. They went down 7,000 feet and found very little. And that, I think, was a great excuse for them, providing all the other incentives there were of low oil prices and so forth, to at least abandon Arctic drilling for at least for now.
Is there a chance that Shell knew this already a month ago when we were talking about the promise of this investment and they kind of went through the motions here? Or is this real news they just found out?
Oh, no, it's real news, and it's not unusual news. I mean, you have busts all the time in areas. And again, there was a lot of pressure for Shell to not sink a second well and to disappear here. And I think the environmentalists deserve a bit of a pat on the back. I think they added a lot of pressure to Shell to take this as a really good excuse to abandon the Arctic, at least for now.
But this still might be a matter of time, right? I mean, Shell and everybody else still believes that there's an ocean of oil underneath there. It's the Arctic. It's hard to get to.
Yeah, it's the potential that's there that's just so compelling. And I don't think this is the end of Arctic drilling at all. But what it is, it's an economic question now. So you're going to wait, and Shell is going to wait, until oil is well over $100 a barrel again for them to even think about going back up there again. Remember, you don't get a barrel of oil. The break-even price for Arctic oil is very, very high. It's some of the highest in the world.
So maybe a momentary reprieve for environmental forces who did not like the idea of Shell investing billions to sink a well in the Arctic. That well has gone bust. Dan Dicker, the author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Thanks, Dan.
Oh, thanks a lot, Todd. Appreciate it.
Of course, we always want your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can ask me anything on Twitter about politics, about Congress, about anything you hear on the show. I'm at Todd Zwillick. And of course, you can find the show at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.